Welcome to First Fuel, a fortnightly podcast bringing you perspectives on the role of energy efficiency, energy management and demand response in the energy transition taking place in Australia and around the world. I'm Luke Menzel, CEO of the Energy Efficiency Council, and this week I'm joined by Alyssa Fisher, an energy policy analyst specialising in energy efficiency at the International Energy Agency. Alyssa, welcome to the podcast, and it's fantastic to make your acquaintance, not in person, but over Zoom, and expanding on our Twitter friendship that we've developed over the last year or so. How are you there in Paris?
Yeah, hey, Luke. Thanks for having me again. I'm really delighted to be here. Things are going well here. It's a sunny day, and happy to get to chat about energy efficiency with you.
Well, indeed. And the prompt for today's conversation is the op-ed, the fantastic op-ed you penned recently on a really crucial topic, the role of energy efficiency in achieving our net zero ambitions. The link to that op-ed will be in the show notes, and I encourage anyone listening, if you've got time, pause the podcast, go and read Alyssa's op-ed, and then press play again, and it'll all make a bit more sense. But before we get into the detail of the op-ed, I want to sort of unpack what is involved in hitting a net zero target. And it seems to be that the really important thing to understand from an IEA perspective is the sustainable development scenario. A lot of your thinking on that front really hinges on that scenario. Can you tell us a bit about the sustainable development scenario, what it is, and the big chunks of abatement potential identified in that scenario?
You know, it's really an exciting and positive trend that we've been seeing from countries to make more ambitious commitments, especially to get to net zero by 2050. You know, there's 44 countries in the world plus the EU who are setting that target, and that's huge. That's 70% of the global GDP and 70% of energy-related emissions. So, you know, it's a really concrete goal that I think we as the energy efficiency community and the wider energy transition community are all working towards, and we can all get behind. And so that's helping us to set these more have these more concrete targets in mind when we look at scenarios like the sustainable development scenario. So how do we get there? That's you know, a complicated question. There's lots of different solutions, each with their pros and cons. And the sustainable development scenario, you know, it doesn't tell governments what they need to do or bias one solution over another. But, you know, our scenarios, they make a forecast of what different paths forward are going to look like for the energy sector. You know, they look at existing technologies and policies and commitments and a bunch of other factors to help predict what would happen in the future, given a certain set of circumstances. And so we've got a few different scenarios. You know, there's the stated policy scenario or STEPS, which takes into consideration the concrete policies that governments have already, you know, announced or implemented. And that's kind of like the control group, you could say, what we compare other pathways against. And then we have the sustainable development scenario that you mentioned, which takes, you know, the SDGs, the sustainable development goals, as its basis and looks, you know, how do we achieve the SDGs, you know, working backwards from those targets to see what we need to achieve them. And it's really, you know, realistic, pragmatic, cost effective. It's based on the existing technologies and financing and policy mechanisms that exist. But, you know, even the sustainable development scenario doesn't take us to net zero by 2050. It's not quite ambitious enough. And in fact, you know, we're talking about the sustainable development scenario, but I think it's important to note that in our most recent World Energy Outlook that came out in October, they developed the net zero by 2050 scenario, which does, you know, help us identify what that pathway could look like. And next week, we will also be releasing our special report on net zero by 2050 that takes an even more ambitious look at all of the drastic and really transformational changes that need to be made to achieve that goal. You know, I can't give too much insight into what the findings are right now because the report hasn't been released, but, you know, it's going to be ambitious, and it's also going to rely heavily on energy efficiency solutions, which is pretty exciting.
So I guess in terms of some of these scenarios that are charting a positive course forward, and I think it's really important to note that these are scenarios. They have different endpoints. They make different assumptions. It's really an opportunity to think our way into what is a sort of an uncertain future in terms of how we chart this transition, but it helps us imagine what that world could look like, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But in all of them, energy efficiency plays a really crucial role in that transition. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in the SDS, the sustainable development scenario, which, as we said, what gets us to, I think, net zero by like 2070, but it's not, you know, not nearly as ambitious as net zero by 2050. 40% of the abatement comes from energy efficiency. That's, you know, a very significant portion, not quite half, but almost. And that includes efficiency measures both on the demand side and the supply side. It looks like improving efficiency in homes and offices and factories and transport, and also improving the efficiency of power generation and distribution. You know, it shows us that we're going to need to really invest in a wide range of measures to achieve net zero by 2050. And, you know, it's important to note as well that most of the technology that is needed already exists and already is cost effective. And the real problem is that we're not doing enough of it. We're not, you know, we're not having strong enough commitments. We're not being ambitious enough. It's going to take a lot of ambition and transformational action across the sector and across lots of different types of technologies in order to achieve our goal. It's going to take an all hands on board approach, really.
And the thing that always strikes me about that big chunk, that 40 plus percent that we need energy efficiency to deliver in terms of abatement, is that it's a big chunk in aggregate, but actually it's a lot of little slivers that are stacked on top of each other, addressing a bunch of different technologies and a bunch of different sectors. And that's the great challenge for policymakers, and I guess the great challenge for us all is grasping that potential relative to something like renewables, because renewables is a relatively homogenous technology. Whereas in the energy efficiency space, there's these discrete opportunities and barriers in every part of the economy. And so I guess the question for us all is how we address ourselves to those challenges and get our hands dirty, roll up our sleeves, unpicking them so that we can unlock that opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you say, it's made up of lots of tiny different slivers of lots of different technologies and different solutions in different sectors. You know, we need a massive uptake of electric vehicles, which, you know, not only are they cleaner than conventional vehicles, but they're also 3 to 5 times more efficient, you know, per unit of energy. We need more efficient appliances like lighting, refrigerators, TVs, and air conditioners. You know, the air conditioner sector is set to explode as the middle class, especially in emerging economies, grows. And that requires a lot of different policy instruments and incentives, like more stringent energy performance standards, better incentive schemes. You know, we need to get these more efficient appliances into every home and office and store and factory, you know, to ensure that we have a full market transformation and not just that, you know, very wealthy folks are getting access to these efficient appliances and poorer people and people without as many resources are stuck using these old, less efficient appliances that are, you know, discarded. It needs this full sectoral transformation. You know, similarly, we need deep retrofits of homes. We see retrofits, you know, shallow retrofits, I guess you could call them, where people, you know, fix one aspect of their home. They upgrade the lighting, or they upgrade the insulation, or they, you know, improve, you know, their heating, replace their heater with a heat pump. And those are all good things to do. But in order to really ramp up our ambition, we need deep retrofits, which go beyond these one-off upgrades to insulation or heating. And, you know, it's a really comprehensive stock take of the efficiency of a building, and, you know, requires a full suite of upgrades, like, you know, to the heating and to the building envelope, to the heating and cooling systems, to lighting, and, you know, those kind of comprehensive renovations are really powerful, and they can improve the energy efficiency of buildings by up to 50% per square meter. That's really impressive. And, you know, and that's not something that we can do at small scale either. You know, to achieve net zero, we need to do that at a really wide scale. We need to really ramp up the ambition of this already ambitious project. Our research has found that in order to achieve net zero, we'll need to do that in 2 million houses per month in advanced economies. It's huge. It's a huge number. You know, we need government to really lead the way in in making those changes, whether that's through policy or through leading by example, by, you know, investing in the efficiency of their own infrastructure, of their own buildings, of their own vehicle fleets. You know, some of the most ambitious and interesting projects we see are where governments are leading by example. They're in prioritizing efficiency in, you know, public and social housing upgrades or in their own municipal buildings. You know, and we see that these types of programs, especially around social housing and in vulnerable communities, they not only reduce energy costs for those communities and for those households and mitigate carbon emissions, which is, you know, of course, one of the primary goals that we're trying to achieve with these interventions, but also they create tons of jobs, which is especially important at this moment. You know, we found in our recent analysis on the special, you know, in our special report on sustainable recovery, we found that energy efficiency investment, especially in buildings, creates more jobs per, you know, per unit spent than any other energy sector. And, you know, that's a meaningful statistic that politicians and policymakers really need to consider as they decide what they want to spend their money on when they're creating, you know, these stimulus and recovery packages.
I think many in our audience would be very inspired by you laying out the opportunity. But I do run across people, Alyssa, who say, well, it all sounds a bit hard. Energy efficiency, it's, you know, it does take time and attention and a lot of fairly detailed interventions. And, you know, we're doing such a great job of decarbonising the electricity sector. Why don't we just not worry about that efficiency stuff and we'll decarbonise electricity, transition to 100% renewables, and we don't have to worry about that sort of finicky, complex energy efficiency stuff. It strikes me that the IEA does not have that view, has not subscribed to that view. I'm interested in you explaining to me why that is.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, we get that same feedback too. And the fact of the matter is it's not realistic. Energy efficiency is incredibly important for clean energy transitions for, you know, a number of reasons. You know, firstly, we can't reach net zero without it. It's, you know, it's a simple fact. And no matter how quickly we decarbonize the energy supply, it's just not enough to reach net zero by 2050. When we consider the practicalities of the matter, you know, renewables require space. Renewables require storage facilities, and those are in short supply in many places. Similarly, renewables are really material intensive. If you look at our recent report on critical materials and clean energy transitions, we found that in order to reach net zero, you're going to need 6 times the amount of critical minerals that we currently extract by 2040. And if we, you know, if we want to ramp up that demand any more dramatically, that could lead to significant supply constraints, not to mention the environmental impacts of, you know, mining for those critical minerals. And, you know, we talk about supply constraints. We already see that happening. You know, just look at the past year. Due to the COVID pandemic, supply chains were very disrupted. And in Australia, you know, you saw the impacts of that quite tangibly. Manufacturing backlogs led to the secondhand car market. You know, the price is rising as much as 37% in Australia. And that's a real tangible impact that I think people can acknowledge is not good and not something that we want to pursue and not something that we want to fall back on. It's not sustainable, and increasing demand for these materials, you know, would exacerbate supply chain issues in a similar way. You know, likewise, we can't ignore the big part that fossil fuels play in many economies around the world, as much as we might like to deny it or
wave a magic wand.
Yeah. I'm not saying that, you know, I'm not arguing in favor of fossil fuels, but practically putting all our eggs in the renewable basket just won't work based on the realities of the world that we live in. You know, and also there are some sectors that just aren't really ready yet. You know, the net zero transition relies on carbon capture technology and low emission aviation. And, you know, regardless of how quickly we roll out renewables, those sectors aren't ready to meet demand yet. So energy efficiency is really needed because it makes the whole task easier. It makes everything that we want to do easier. It's a really powerful tool for reducing demand, improving access to energy services, and so much more. you know, without energy efficiency, we will massively overbuild the energy infrastructure and the systems that we need to meet demand, which is way more costly than the improvements that we need to make our efficiency, our systems more efficient from the get-go. So, you know, when we improve the efficiency of our energy consumption, the hard things that we need to do become much easier. Like, the more we improve efficiency, the fewer debates we have to have about where we're going to install a wind farm or how we're going to build enough resilient generation capacity to handle another crisis, like the blizzard we saw in Texas this winter. It's just a reality that we can't achieve our climate goals without energy efficiency. You know, the population of the world and the energy demand that goes along with it are growing too rapidly, and energy efficiency is just the most cost-effective and the easiest way to mitigate that demand while allowing people to still access the essential services that energy provides, and without which sustainable development and economic development and social development really aren't possible.
Alyssa, I'm reminded of one of your commissioners on the Global... What was it, the Global Commission for Urgent Action on Energy Efficiency that the IEA pulled together last year?
And, yeah, exactly.
We had Michael Liebreich on the podcast, I believe episode 11 for those playing along at home. And I said to him, oh, look, you know, it's a reality that we probably can't meet our net zero goals without energy efficiency. And he said, no, Luke, you got to stiffen your spine, mate. We can't do it. We absolutely can't do it. So
It's not possible.
So I would co-sign everything you've just said, and I think it's important to, you know, underline that. I think I can speak for both of us, Alyssa, that we're both massive boosters of renewables. It's just that it's renewables plus, right? It's not that, you know, these things aren't in competition. The two things I'd add to that very excellent list is that net zero is great, fantastic. It's good to have a target, but the thing that we can't lose sight of is cumulative emissions. Mm-hmm. And so the reality is, which you pointed to, is that all economies around the world are going to be pretty dependent on fossil fuels in some way, shape, or form for some time to come. And I'm not even going to say a number or how many years or decades it'll take to wean ourselves off fossil fuels, because that's not the debate that I'm trying to have. It's just a reality that we're not going to switch them off tomorrow. And so energy efficiency, the more energy efficiency we can inject into fossil fuel dominated systems, brings down those cumulative emissions and gives us more headroom to solve some of those really tricky issues we have in certain sectors of the economy that it's going to take some time to grapple with, and so that's really important. The other thing that I'd add to your list is grappling with how to manage high penetration renewable energy systems. And if we think about energy efficiency holistically and incorporate energy management and load flexibility and control into that, that makes that task so much easier, particularly as we electrify. It gives us those demand side resources to balance the system that is becoming increasingly dominated by intermittent renewable generation. So it actually supports increased penetration of renewables. And so there's so many reasons that, you know, you and I are passionate about this topic and keep banging the drum, and I turn up every couple of weeks to talk to good people like yourself to explain why this is so crucial, because it absolutely is. It's something that we really need to get our head around, despite, you know, the challenges of unlocking that potential.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. And I think you raise a really important point about, you know, digital technologies and digitalization of energy systems. You know, digital energy systems and, you know, digital technologies and smart cities and whatever you want to call them, you know, they're improving our capacity for integrating renewables, as you say, integrating distributed renewables and improving demand management and grid flexibility in ways that, you know, were never possible before without these new and evolving technologies. You know, we can now leverage big data to look at, you know, the weather patterns and energy demand forecasts to really optimize the consumption across an entire grid. And we can, you know, use those tools to avoid spikes in consumption, or, you know, increase consumption when renewables are strong and reduce it when fossil fuels are more, you know, prevalent on the grid. And all of these all of these new tools are helping to increase the value, I guess you would say, or the utilization potential of renewables. So they really work hand in hand, as you say. They're not competing. It's not a one or the other type situation. We really need them to work together, and we need all of the all of the solutions on the table to be able to achieve our goals.
First Fuel is brought to you by the Energy Efficiency Council, a not-for-profit membership association for businesses, universities, governments, and NGOs. The Council's mission is to unlock the potential of energy efficiency to deliver healthy, comfortable buildings, productive, competitive businesses, and an affordable, reliable, and sustainable energy system for Australia. To find out how your organisation can get involved, visit eec.org.au/membership.
All right. Well, now that we've concluded spruiking the good news of energy efficiency, maybe we can turn to where we find ourselves here. Sure. in 2021. And I'm reminded of the episode I recorded at the end of last year with your colleague Jeremy, who took me through the numbers in the latest energy efficiency market report, and they went rosy reading. And given the premise of your op-ed is, well, we need to accelerate our rate of improvement in terms of energy performance to hit our net zero goals. The reality that Jeremy laid out and has been unfortunately laid out in a number of energy efficiency market reports that have been released by the IEA over the last number of years is that we're actually going backwards. I'm not sure where you want to take that. It strikes me that we're looking at quite a big turnaround to unlock the potential that we've just been talking about.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And for those who haven't listened to Jeremy's podcast or read the market report, our research showed that energy efficiency was going to fall, or investment was going to fall by 9% in 2020, and the energy intensity would only improve by 0.8%. And, you know, we can say, yeah, it was an atypical year. There was this horrible pandemic and, you know, it disrupted lots of industries, especially the energy industry. But we can't just blame the pandemic for this challenge. I mean, energy intensity improvement has been declining steadily since it peaked in 2015. And that peak was 2.9%, which isn't even high enough to achieve, the SDGs, which aren't even strong enough to achieve net zero by 2050, yeah. I mean, we're just simply not doing enough, to achieve the SDGs. We need to have an annual improvement rate of 3% all the way through 2030. And we're not close to doing that. As we've been discussing, to achieve that, we need this all hands on deck approach. We need governments to lock in ambitious energy efficiency investment right now. And we need all of those, efficiency best practices that we know and love. You know, we need to dial them up to 11. We know it works. We know what needs to be done. We just need to do it. We need to put it on steroids and, lay down a strong, solid foundation of these best practices quickly and at a really broad scale. And then once we do that, we can start to ask, what's next? What are the next generation of energy efficiency solutions, like digitalization, like smart cities, like, behavioral nudges to help take it to the next level, to get to that next step. Additionally, we're at this moment right now where all people are looking towards COP26. And that's a really interesting opportunity as well, because it's really important to achieve this goal that countries really collaborate and learn from each other and develop solutions together. You know, it'll be interesting to see in November, how global collaboration is really going to accelerate progress, how countries are working together to make more ambitious commitments and start new initiatives to turn that ambition into action. One of the initiatives that we're working on and that we're really excited about is, with the UK, where we're working on this, product efficiency call to action. And that is focused on improving efficiency in some key appliance categories like, lighting, cooling, industrial motors. And the way that it works is by bringing together lots of different countries from emerging economies and advanced economies to make commitments and really push for next generation in innovation and also policy, like, you know, minimum energy performance standards that are, you know, hiked up and all these other incentives and regulations that help to push the market forward and transform it. You know, and so in essence, we're standing at a really important moment right now. We could go one way or the other. You know, we can either lock in these high emission infrastructure and energy systems for the next 30 years with the investments we make today, or we can take this opportunity to invest heavily in efficient and sustainable and climate positive infrastructure and energy systems that will have positive outcomes for decades. And you know, the moment that we're in right now is really important, and it's really unique. You know, and I'm not trying to say that, you know, COVID was a positive thing or anything. Of course not. Absolutely not. But the creation, you know, what has come out at the end is all of these recovery and stimulus packages have created an opportunity to really create a new future and to make the change that we want to see, make these transformations real because of just the intensity of investment that's happening right now. And we just need to take advantage of it. And we need private sector, civil society, government, everyone working together to make sure we lock in that more sustainable net zero future right now.
I think it was June last year that the IEA and the IMF released that sustainable recovery report, which quick off the mark, a few months into the pandemic, but really providing some early guidance to governments around the world on how they could best harness their stimulus spending to deliver a double dividend, restarting the global economy as well, starting to deal with these long-term, relatively intractable problems. So that report providing a huge amount of valuable guidance to government. I'm interested in your thoughts, Alyssa, on the degree to which that call has been heeded. Obviously, we're not out of the woods. There's a lot of water to go under the bridge before we emerge from this both health and economic crisis around the world. But there are a lot of plans out in the market at this point. Mm. And so to what degree is that focus on sustainable recovery investments, particularly as the rate to clean energy broadly, but also energy efficiency specifically, is that playing out in the plans that are being released by governments?
You know, as you say, we were doing some research early on in the pandemic on what stimulus plans could look like, how they can incorporate energy efficiency, how they can support clean energy transitions. And to do that, we looked back at what happened in 2008, 2009 during the financial crisis. And we found that, you know, countries simply weren't investing in energy efficiency through their stimulus packages. And so when we compare these two crises, yes, countries are absolutely taking advantage of the opportunity much more strongly than they did. And we can't say otherwise. We are certainly seeing some really interesting packages coming out, especially around investment in building efficiency, around electric vehicles. But, you know, at the same time, it's not nearly enough. You know, we really need to, if we want to reach net zero by 2050, we need to ramp those up in a really big way. So, you know, there's still time. As you say, the pandemic, it hasn't, you know, this isn't in the past. This is happening right now. We're still trying to figure out how do we solve the health crisis, and also how do we get economies back on track? How do you get people back to work? How do you, you know, stimulate consumer spending? And energy efficiency and clean energy investment can be a big part of that. And you know, additionally, as we were talking about, COP26 is coming up, and a lot of countries are revising their NDCs, which are going to help, you know, solidify some of that ambition and put it in writing and make commitments to achieving those goals, which can be paired with stimulus spending. And we're also hoping to see that development banks over the next 6 months start making commitments in the lead up to COP26 that will help accelerate investment in emerging economies as well, especially around energy efficiency and clean energy infrastructure. And so, you know, while we can't say that we're seeing everything that we want to see and everything's perfect and beautiful and shiny, we're definitely seeing progress and there's still time and there's still a ways to go. And we're looking forward to seeing more countries coming out with even more ambitious commitments and policies and plans. And at the IA, we're tracking all of this. We're looking at all these commitments. We're looking at these investments that governments are making for a broad sustainable recovery, not just energy investment, but also renewable energy and other clean energy technologies. But that analysis is still ongoing. And, as the commitments are coming out, we're tracking them. We're trying to understand what the impact of those will be. And we will be publishing a more comprehensive overview this summer to take stock of how countries are stepping up to the challenge. But, at this point, it's as you say, it's still ongoing. So we'll see what happens.
We will see what happens. It's all in flight. The ones that have, or the plans that have stood out to me over the last 12 months, the work that's been done in the European Union around, the renovation wave, as some mm-hmm. call it, which goes to your point earlier about the rate of deep retrofits that we need to see is across the built environment is astonishing.
Absolutely.
But if you're ever going to get started on building that momentum, it would be now. And there seems to be some appetite in mm-hmm. at least in Europe and some of the key member states to get that ball rolling. And you can see a similar impulse in President Biden's stimulus plans as well. Weatherization features very strongly in the infrastructure package that mm-hmm. is being pulled together and has some prospect of getting through Congress later in the year. So it's interesting, isn't it? Obviously there's been a range of people trying to help shape the thinking of governments as to what would be productive stimulus in this space, IEA and IMF and of course a number of others, but in a very crowded environment with a lot of people yelling very loudly around what government should be doing,
ourselves included.
it seems that message has gotten through to some degree. And the other thing that strikes me about the US and the EU is big economies that have the wherewithal to really test the proposition of how you might ramp up that program, how you might get up to scale, and it's the right place to be doing that learning. With the resources that they have as first world nations, I'd probably say Australia could probably do a bit on that front as well. We might get there eventually. We'll see how we go, Alyssa. We're working on that, but there's reasons for optimism, and they're just a couple of examples that stand out to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you mentioned the EU renovation wave. That's a really, landmark, history-making commitment that we're seeing. The EU renovation wave, for those who aren't aware, it is trying to double the rate of deep renovations across Europe and retrofit 35 million homes by 2030. And that's huge. That's so ambitious. It's so, so ambitious. And frankly, we're really interested to see how they're going to pull it off. That's going to require a lot of money, a lot of time. It's going to require a lot of investment in capacity, bringing people, creating a whole new workforce around deep retrofits. We also see in the UK, part of their plan requires a massive rollout of heat pumps. And maybe this isn't, specifically stimulus related, but, to achieve that goal, we're going to have to do massive training to teach the majority of the HVAC, workforce how to install heat pumps, because that's just not a skill that is widely known. We see these massive commitments that you're seeing from advanced economies are impressive and ambitious. As I said before, they can still go further. Of course, we can always go further. We look at what Canada is doing. They recently announced a $4.4 billion fund for interest-free loans for deep retrofits of homes. That's impressive. That's huge. And especially since it's directed specifically at deep retrofits. I think what you're asking about, well, what can Australia do? That is perhaps a good example to look to, because, Canada is in a similar context to Australia. It's a fossil fuel rich country. It's similar in size, similar in development level. And so that example might be interesting to Australian policymakers. They also have a healthy communities initiative that's pretty interesting, that's committing a ton of money to supporting walking and cycling initiatives across the country. And while we don't think of those technically traditionally as efficiency initiatives because they're not technology-based, they certainly are. Walking is infinitely more efficient than, you know, driving a car. Cycling is even more efficient because you get where you need to go faster, right? And that's improving the efficiency, improving the emissions of the transport system as a whole. So if we can take a broad view to what energy efficiency looks like, we can see that there are such a vast array of opportunities and options for countries based on, you know, what are their needs, what are their priorities, and what do the communities who live in their cities and towns need to make their lives better?
Well, I know that we've got at least one or two energy efficiency policymakers that tune into the podcast, Alyssa. So hopefully, in an Australian context, they feel inspired to go and click through on the links that we'll pepper in the show notes to the various programs that you've just mentioned. We're out of time. I just want to say that I'm sure that our listeners appreciate the passion and expertise you bring to this topic. We're really lucky to have people like you working at the IEA that are investing so much time and energy into this space. I've said it to some of your colleagues previously on the podcast, but it's the IEA is playing a really important role as a clearinghouse for this complex but important policy topic. It's breaking down silos between nations. Ultimately, you know, there's we're all in varying circumstances in different countries around the world, but these are not unique issues from country to country. There's a lot that we can learn, and the role that you play in sharing and building connective tissue, communicating some of those learnings is incredibly valuable. So thank you, and more power to you. And we look forward to next week and your latest intervention in this space on that pathway to net zero.
Yeah, it's going to be an exciting release. So stay tuned. Thank you so much for having me today. It was really a pleasure to speak with you.
Oh, look, it's an absolute pleasure, and I'll catch you on Twitter sometime soon, no doubt.
Sounds good. I'll see you there.
That wraps up this episode of First Fuel. If you have comments, you can find us on Twitter. Alyssa is at Alicia Fisher, and my handle is at Luke Menzel. And to keep up to date on the latest in energy efficiency, energy management, demand response, you can follow the Energy Efficiency Council at EE Council. If Twitter is not your thing, you can email the team. The address is firstfuel@eec.org.au, and make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to First Fuel in your podcast app of choice. To learn more about the show, including upcoming live recordings, visit eec.org.au/podcasts. But for now, it's goodbye from us, and we'll catch you soon.
Wonderful. Thanks. This was so much fun.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. It's great to connect. I'm impressed by the only other thing I want to say is very impressed by your knowledge of the Australian secondhand car market.
I have to say, I did ask my Australian buds for some tips on things to talk about. That's not original content.
Well, you pulled it off very well.
Thanks.